including one arson and two burglaries. That left three unsolved burglaries and a rape. Two of the unsolved burglaries were break-ins that seemed to have been committed by more than one person at a time, and large amounts of cash and jewelry were taken. In one case, the burglars were captured on security camera video. She dismissed those two cases as well. All that remained were a burglary and a rape. The burglary case was a DOA report out of Calabasas, an elderly woman who was convinced she was burglarized, even though there were no signs of a break-in and nothing valuable was taken. That could either be forgetfulness, to put it kindly, or a promising lead. Eve would check that one out. And finally, there was a rape. A young woman in West Hills walked in her door from work and was raped by a man who was waiting in her home. He was wearing a monster mask and held a knife to her throat. No arrest was made in the case, and no DNA was collected. But Eve was still intrigued by the parallels between the unsolved rape and her case, especially with the tenuous coil connection. Rather than read the report, Eve decided to call the investigating detective, who worked out of the sex crimes division downtown, to find out more. The detective answered on the first ring.
Sex crimes, McCahan.
This is Detective Eve Ronan, RHD, out of the Lost Hills Station.
The Death Fist, he said.
She kept talking as if she hadn't heard him say that. I'm working a triple homicide, and you investigated a rape case that might be connected with mine.
You're working a triple homicide, he said. Let me ask you a question. Before this, what was the biggest case you investigated?
I'm not doing this dance, Detective. A woman and her two children were murdered and dismembered in her home. I think I've got the guy who did it sitting in a cell here. You can help me keep him here by talking to me about a case, or you can help him walk by wasting my time with bullshit. What's it going to be? He sighed.
What's the case of mine?
It was a rape 8 months ago in West Hills. The victim's name was Vicky Denhoff. What can you tell me about it?
It was a heartbreaker. Denhoff is in her early 30s, lives alone, and is an accountant for an insurance company in Warner Center. She wasn't feeling well, so her boss let her go home early. She walked into her house, went to her bedroom, and some guy in a mask jumped her from behind, put a knife to her throat, and told her he'd cut her if she screamed or didn't do exactly what he told her. To prove he was serious, he sliced her just deep enough to draw blood. He forced her onto the bed and raped her.
The man was already in the house when she came home?
That's right.
Was there any sign of a break-in?
Nope.
Did she describe the mask he was wearing?
Only that it was a monster mask that covered his head completely, he said. She closed her eyes through most of it.
Were you able to collect any DNA? She knew from browsing the report that the answer was no, but she wanted to know why.
Have you ever seen that TV show Monk about that uptight detective who is a clean freak and wants everything to be even?
He had OCD.
Yeah, well, she's like him. Can't stand dirt. So the moment he was gone, she didn't just shower and douche, she did it 5 or 6 times, completely disinfected herself, washed her clothes and her sheets before throwing them out, cleaned her entire house, and then called the police. I understand why she did it, of course, but she went to such an extreme that she virtually guaranteed we'd never be able to convict anyone for the rape. Vicky was victimized twice, first by the rapist, and then by her own phobias. I felt terrible for her.
She still might be able to help put him away, Eve said.
You think your guy is her rapist?
There's a connection. He was a plumber who did a service call in her house a few weeks prior to the rape.
That could be a coincidence.
There's also a lot about the two cases that's similar. In both cases, he was waiting in the house for the victims. He had a knife, and there were no signs of a break-in. We also found an ape suit in his closet.
An ape suit, McCahan repeated.
Full body. Have you ever come across that before?
Rapists who wear animal costumes? Yeah, I've seen that before. I arrested a guy who dressed up like a bear and raped little boys. The rapist admitted to me, to prove that he was just a normal guy with normal urges, that he was part of a group of software designers that held furry parties. What are furry parties? Gatherings where everybody dresses up as animals and jerk off. One of the other guys at this furry party dressed up like a dog and had 3 Labradors at home that he sexually abused. We arrested him for bestiality. Here's a fun fact. I read a study about furries, people who get off wearing animal costumes, and the researcher says that 25% of them believe they aren't entirely human and wish they could become completely inhuman. She was glad she didn't have McAhan's job. Sounds like the guy you caught and the one I have in a cell succeeded in that goal. If you clear the Denoff case with yours, he said, I'll owe you one, Death Fist. You can start by calling me Eve. Let's wait and see if you pull off the doubleheader. Chapter 24. Esther Sandell was a widow in her mid-80s with some kind of bone disease that nearly bent her in half, but she still spent 2 or 3 months a year traveling around the world. I may not have the body I once had, Esther had told the LASD detective who'd taken her initial burglary report, but I still have my head. The comment made such a strong impression on the detective, or amused him so much that he'd put it in his report. It was Esther's way of saying she wasn't senile and the things that were missing from her house were stolen, not misplaced. They weren't particularly valuable things in terms of financial worth, but were rich in memories. She'd returned from one of her trips, noticed some trinkets were gone, and called the sheriff's department. That's what had brought a detective to her duplex on Park Sorrento in Calabasas 8 months ago, and why Eve was back today. Esther lived on Calabasas Lake, a private park that was home to ducks and notoriously aggressive geese that were so violent, deputies were often called by irate homeowners wanting the fowls shot. The Calabasas Park Homeowners Association, wary of lawsuits from their notorious litigious residents, erected signs around the lake warning people not to piss off the birds. This is a surprise, Esther said, leaning on her gnarled carved wood cane as she led Eve out onto her patio overlooking the lake. She was Gandalf without the beard. I thought you'd written me off as a senile old bat. Not at all, Eve said. There just weren't any leads for us to pursue. They sat down at one of the tables. So what has changed? I'd like you to browse through these photos and tell me if you recognize any items, Eve said, passing her phone across to Esther. Nan had sent Eve all the pictures of everything in Coyle's bottom dresser drawer. Do you know how to swipe? Infants who can't even talk yet can use iPads and iPhones, Esther said. What makes you think I can't? Sorry, Eve said. Esther swiped rapidly through the photos with a knobby, arthritic finger for a minute or two, then froze. What is it? Eve asked. Esther's finger trembled over the screen. In the summer of 1975, my husband and I were driving through France in this horrible little Citroën. Our car broke down in some village in the middle of nowhere. We had no money, so we stayed in a room above the mechanic's garage overnight while he fixed our car. My daughter was conceived that night. She turned the camera to show Eve the picture. It was a leather keychain with the Citroën logo, 2 chevrons on a metal medallion. We kept this as a memento. Eve's suspicion was now confirmed. Coyle's bottom dresser drawer was full of objects that he stole from the homes that he'd visited on service calls. Most of the knickknacks weren't overtly valuable. They were personal trinkets that he could slip into his pocket and that could go missing without being noticed by the owners for days, months, or even years. The items didn't prove that he was anything more than a thief, but they raised important questions. Did he steal the items on his service calls, or did he come back later when nobody was home and keep the items as souvenirs of his secret intrusions? If so, did Tanya catch him in the act? Was that the reason for his homicidal fury? Now Eve was even more interested in showing Coyle's collection of knickknacks to Vicky Denhoff, the rape victim, to confirm her suspicions about his activities.
"Will I get this back?" Esther asked.
Eve nodded. "But it might be a while."
"I can wait," Esther said. "I intend to take it with me when I go."
"Go where?"
"To the grave, dear," Esther said. "I'm taking my wedding ring, the keychain, the first love letter Ira wrote to me, and the mink he bought me that I can't wear in public anymore."
Chapter 25. Vicky Denhoff lived in a decades-old, one-story ranch-style home on Julie Lane in West Hills, which was once the westernmost edge of Canoga Park, until it split off into its own community in the late 1980s. The corner of West Hills that Denhoff lived in was under LASD jurisdiction, while the rest of the community fell under the LAPD's protection. The exterior of the house was clean and meticulously maintained. The lawn was so perfectly manicured and green, and the bushes so symmetrically trimmed, that Eve had to touch grass and the leaves on her way to the front door to be sure the landscaping was real and not plastic. Eve had called ahead to make sure Vicky was there, and so she'd be emotionally prepared for the question she might be asked. Vicky opened the door so quickly, Eve suspected she'd been standing at the peephole watching her approach.
"Detective Ronan?" Vicky asked.
She wasn't the OCD cliche that Eve was expecting, which was a socially awkward, demure woman with a severe haircut and wearing bland but perfectly pressed clothes that were buttoned up to the neck and didn't show any skin. She wore a loose-fitting, navy and white gingham sundress, scoop-necked with thin shoulder straps that showed off her shoulders and cleavage. Her curly blonde hair was styled in a simple, messy bob. Eve flashed her badge.
"Thank you for seeing me on such short notice, Ms. Denhoff. I'm sorry to intrude on your Saturday afternoon. This won't take long."
"Please, call me Vicky."
She stepped aside and let Eve in. The house, unlike Vicky, did fit the cliche. It was impeccably clean, not a speck of dust or anything out of place. The furniture and artwork were all centered in relation to the walls behind them, and the pieces evenly spaced. It looked like a furniture store or a display of some kind, rather than a place where a person lived and relaxed.
"What can I do for you?"
There was a hesitancy in Vicky's voice that Eve could sympathize with. Vicky was wary of opening old wounds. "As I said on the phone, I'm investigating a case that could be related to yours, but I'm not going to ask you to go back over everything again. I'd just like you to look at some pictures and tell me if you recognize any of the items." Eve took out her phone and held it out to her. Vicky regarded the screen, which was smudged with greasy fingerprints, and frowned.
"Let's sit down. You can scroll through the pictures, and I'll stop you if I see something I recognize. Is that okay?"
"Of course," Eve said, feeling stupid for not cleaning her dirty phone before offering it to a germaphobe. They sat down side by side on the couch, and Eve slowly swiped through the photos of the things in Coyle's drawer. They went through about 24 items before Vicky said something, her eyebrows arching with surprise.
"That's mine."
She pointed to a picture of a miniature teacup.
"How do you know?"
"It was part of a 4-piece tea set that was in a huge antique dollhouse that belonged to my mother. The dollhouse is long gone, but I kept the tea set on a bookshelf in the guest room where my mom stays when she visits. One day, I noticed a teacup was gone."
"Was this day before or after you were attacked?"
"After," she said, her voice a little shaky. "2 weeks after. My mom came to stay with me when I was recovering. When I was cleaning up the room prior to her arrival, I saw that the cup was gone. It really threw me. I mean, what was I supposed to do? There was no way I could replace the cup before Mom got here, and I couldn't leave it like that. I had no choice but to remove one of the cups and hope for the best."
"I don't understand," Eve said. "Why did you remove a cup?"
"So there would be 2 cups left instead of 3, Vicky said,
What would Mom think if she saw the room in disarray? She'd be even more concerned about me than she already was. The two cups worked out fine while she was here. She was too busy fussing over me to care. But after she left, I couldn't live with it. Two cups would have been fine for anybody else who didn't know they were part of a set. But I knew. I couldn't fool myself, and so I ended up throwing them all away. Eve nodded, not because she thought what Vicky did was the common sense thing to do, but to buy herself some time to decide whether to show her one more photo, one that could cause her some pain. Vicky asked, "Where did you find my cup?" "We found it in the home of a man we believe attacked another woman," Eve said, and made her decision. "There's another picture I'd like to show you." Eve went online and found a headshot of actor Roddy McDowall in his ape makeup from Planet of the Apes. "Is this the monster mask your attacker was wearing?" She showed Vicky the photo. Vicky stared at it analytically, showing no emotional reaction. "It could be, but I can't be sure," she said, unconsciously touching the spot on her throat that had been cut with the knife. There was no visible scar there, but Eve was sure there was one that Vicky could feel. "My memory of it is blurred. All I know was that it wasn't a human face. I closed my eyes and didn't open them again until he was gone." Eve certainly understood that, and had no interest in bringing back more bad memories for her. She pocketed her phone and stood up. "Thank you, Vicky. You've been a big help." Vicky rose to her feet and walked Eve to the door. "Do you think this is the same man who raped me?" "I think it's very likely," Eve said. "Do you have him in jail?" "Yes, I do." "Keep him there." Vicky opened the door. "I might be able to start sleeping at night with the lights off again." Chapter 26. Eve stopped at the Commons, an outdoor shopping center in Calabasas that was meant to evoke a quaint French village, and got a sandwich and coffee at Le Pain Quotidien, which she ate at a table outside under the shadow of a clock tower that held the world's largest Rolex. She'd never been to France, but she doubted many villages had Rolex clock towers. It was 5 p.m. and beginning to get dark. Her phone vibrated. Eve picked it up and saw that Nan had sent her the photos from Caitlin's camera. She downloaded them and texted Nan. "How much longer are you going to be at Coyle's place?" Nan texted back, "Another hour or so." Eve replied that she was on her way over to get the rundown and asked if there was anything she could bring her. Nan asked for a caramel coconut iced latte from Coffee Bean, which was at the shopping center across the street from the Commons. Eve said that would be no problem. She got a couple of the iced lattes and headed up to the mobile home park, where she saw that there was still a crowd of people, most of them tenants of the park, standing outside the yellow police tape, watching the CSU team do their work at Coyle's place. Eve parked her car, got out with the two lattes, and closed the door with her hip. She handed one of the drinks to Deputy Clayton, who lifted up the yellow tape for her.
"You just became my nominee for Detective of the Year," he said.
"Do you ever take your sunglasses off?" she asked.
"Did the Lone Ranger ever take off his mask?"
She smiled and continued on to Coyle's mobile home. Nan met her outside the carport. Another CSU tech was on his knees outside the open driver's side door of Coyle's Toyota, taking samples from the carpet. Eve handed Nan the latte and she took a big sip.
"Thanks, I've been craving this all day," Nan said. "What do I owe you?"
"I'll settle for a single piece of evidence linking Coyle to the murders of Tanya Kenworth and her kids," Eve said, and got a frown from Nan, indicating they'd come up with nothing so far. "Don't tell me that. What about the work boots?"
"They are the same brand and style of work boot, but not the actual ones that he wore at the scene. This pair is brand new, and they've never been worn. At the crime scene or anywhere else. These were his spares."
"Spares?"
"He has three pairs of the same Nike running shoes, two that are still in boxes and one that he's wearing regularly," My guess is that he waits for sales and then he buys multiple pairs of the shoes he likes.
What about the carpet and floors? Surely he tracked some blood, cleanser, and motor oil into his house.
I won't be 100% certain until we get the samples back to the lab, but there doesn't appear to be any trace evidence from the crime scene in his house. We've checked everything, including the drains and the shower and sinks. Speaking of which, we also checked the drains at Tanya's house, and we didn't find any hairs that match his.
Eve motioned to the Toyota.
You must have found something in his car.
Nan shook her head again.
It's clean.
It was frustrating and infuriating.
So he thoroughly scrubbed his car down after the killings?
Definitely not, Nan said. Eve was confused, and Nan could see it on her face.
When I said it was clean, I meant we haven't found any blood, body fluids, bone fragments, or anything else connected to the crime scene. But outside of that, the car is filthy. See for yourself.
Eve turned and looked at the car. It was covered in dirt, and there was bird crap on the trunk lid and back window. The car obviously hadn't been washed in weeks. It didn't make any sense to her. If the car was clean, how did he get the trash and body parts out of the house? If his mobile home was clean, then where did he go to change his clothes and wash the blood off himself before going shopping at Walmart?
Despite all the evidence pointing to Coyle, there was still a big hole in the narrative, something she hadn't found or couldn't see in front of her that would explain it all and prove him guilty. Unless she figured out fast what it was, Coyle could be bailed out on Monday and only face a burglary charge.
One thought occurred to her. She took out her phone and called Mr. Plunger. Brandy answered cheerfully as usual.
This is Detective Ronan again. I have a quick question. Are your plumbers allowed to take the service vehicles home with them?
No, of course not, Brandy said. Why would they want to do that?
Instead of answering the question, Eve asked another. Were all of your trucks in service on Wednesday and Thursday?
Yes, they were, she said.
There weren't any in the shop or sidelined for any reason?
Nope,
she said. Is your parking lot under video surveillance?
24/7 because of vandalism and people trying to steal tools and parts off the trucks, she said. It's all recorded on DVR that recycles every 60 days.
Thanks for your help. I appreciate it. Eve disconnected the call and saw Nan studying her.
You're wondering how he got the bodies out of the house if he didn't use his car or his plumbing truck, Nan said.
The answer was obvious. He had another car or an accomplice.
Or both, Nan said.
The notion of a second killer had never occurred to Eve until now. Her entire focus for the last 48 plus hours was finding a single individual. She didn't know where to start looking for a second man or woman.
Is there any evidence you've seen that points to a second person? Eve asked.
Nan shrugged.
Sometimes it's the lack of evidence that does the pointing.
Like it did right now, though Eve wasn't convinced that a second person was the missing piece, not that she had the slightest idea what the hell it was. There was just a big, gaping hole in the case. Eve felt a tremble of panic in her chest for the first time since the investigation began. It was the fear of failure and what it would mean. Her promotion to homicide detective would be condemned as a disastrous and irresponsible publicity stunt, one that revealed her arrogance and incompetence and the sheriff's frantic desperation to distract attention from the department's scandals. Their careers would be over and their reputations irreparably destroyed. They would deserve it, too. But the prospect of that shame and ridicule wasn't what scared her the most. It was failing to get justice for Tanya, Caitlin, and Troy. She could not, she would not let that happen.
Chapter 27. Calabasas was divided by steep hills that were designated as permanent open space. There were no roads that cut straight across them. As a result, to get to the other side of the city, it was necessary to take one of three routes. The 101 freeway to the north, the most direct route,
but one that was often clogged with traffic, turning a 3-mile drive into a 30-minute ordeal. Or Mulholland Highway, a 2-lane road that took a long, winding route up and through the hills, but required you to go several miles south and then backtrack north again. Or a zigzag route that paralleled the freeway and crossed over it twice, following the crazy borders of a city created by piecemeal annexations of unincorporated land rather than a rational plan. Eve took the zigzag route back to the Lost Hills station. That meant driving west on Calabasas Road, then north over the freeway to Muro Road, a very narrow, tree-lined street of deep dips, sudden rises, and sharp, blind curves that inexplicably enticed people into speeding and led to frequent and horrific car accidents. But today there was so much traffic on the road, with frustrated commuters using it as an alternative to the clogged freeway, that speeding wasn't an option. She hit the T-intersection with Las Virgenes Road. Turning right would have taken her to the front door of her condo. Instead, she turned left and headed south over the freeway again, following the route she took to work most mornings on her bike. She made a right onto Agora Road and was passing the Goodnight Inn when guilt and responsibility tugged her into making a sharp U-turn and pulling into the hotel's parking lot. Cleve had told her during their encounter outside the Lost Hills station that this was where he'd be staying until the case was closed. The Goodnight Inn was a 2-star, 2-story hotel with a low, 2-figure nightly rate, which brought the kind of clientele that guaranteed the sheriff's deputies visited often. The hotel had outdoor hallways and was buffeted by the sound of traffic rushing past from the freeway on one side and Agora Road on the other. The exhaust fumes settled in the hotel's inner courtyard and mixed with the scent of the heavily chlorinated pool to create a toxic fragrance that kept the mosquitoes away and probably killed bedbugs, too. Eve called Cleve on the phone from her car and asked if she could see him. He told her to come on up and stood waiting for her in the open doorway of his second-floor room as she came up the stairs. He was haggard, his hair askew, his eyes bloodshot, and he wore the wrinkled clothes from the previous night. His skin was pale as if he'd been bled dry. Over his shoulder, Eve saw an unmade bed and a pizza box from Domino's and a liter bottle of Coca-Cola on the floor.
"Have you found my kids?"
he asked, his voice low and hoarse. He stepped out of his doorway and went to the railing, making it clear he didn't want to have this conversation inside his room. "No, but we've arrested a suspect and searched his home. We found this." She held up her phone to show Cleve a picture of the pink camera. "Can you tell me what this is?" Cleve nodded, his chin trembling.
"It's Caitlin's camera. I gave it to her as a birthday present a year ago."
"We found some pictures on it. Can you tell me where they were taken?" She handed him the phone and let him scroll through Caitlin's pictures. All the shots were from a picnic at a lake with her brother, her father, and a golden retriever. There was only one picture of Caitlin, the one with the wet dog shaking off beside her. Caitlin was laughing and turning away, holding her hands up in a futile attempt to protect herself from getting wet, but loving it all the same. It was a picture of pure happiness. Now it was a picture that brought heartbreak. She thought he would have cried if he had any tears left. Instead, his body shook with emotional dry heaves.
"Caitlin took these pictures in August at Lake Yosemite. It's a park up in Merced."
"Did she ever tell you that she'd lost the camera?" He shook his head.
"She might have told her mother, but Caitlin wouldn't have said anything to me. She would have been worried about me being hurt or upset that she'd lost her birthday present."
He handed the camera back to her, his hand shaking.
"Who did you arrest?"
"His name is Lionel Coyle. He's a plumber who did some work at Tanya's house."
"What did you arrest him for?"
"Murder," Eve said, the word catching in her throat. Cleve nodded, went back into his room, and closed the door softly behind him.
Chapter 28.
Eve left the Goodnight Inn and drove the two blocks west to the Lost Hills station. The public parking lot was filled with satellite news trucks from the local TV channels. News of Coyle's arrest must have leaked. She drove past the trucks, through the gate, and into the lot reserved for official vehicles. She went into the building, went straight to the squad room, and saw that Biddle and Garvey were at their desks and on their phones. They both acknowledged her with a nod. Duncan was at his desk, too, working his way through a mountain of paperwork. He looked up at her as she passed.
"Make any progress?"
he asked. "Two steps forward and one step back," she said.
"Let's hear about the steps forward."
Coyle's got a drawer full of little knickknacks, stuff he couldn't fit in his pocket that he stole from the places he serviced as a plumber, she said, and told him about cross-referencing Coyle's service calls with reports of crimes and how that led her to Vicky Denhoff and Esther Sandell. "I think he slipped into their houses later when nobody was home and took the items as souvenirs of his secret visit."
"How much of that can you prove?"
The women picked out their stuff from photos of his collection, and Cleve Kenworth ID'd the pink camera as Caitlin's.
"How do you know he didn't steal those items during his service calls?" Duncan said. "It doesn't prove he broke into the house later or killed Tanya and her kids."
"There's more," she said. "Denhoff came home early from work one day and was raped by a guy wearing a monster mask who was hiding in her bedroom. I think Tanya walked in on him in her house."
"Did we get any DNA from Denhoff's rapist?"
Eve shook her head. She cleaned herself up before reporting the rape.
"Is that the step back?"
"No, it's bigger than that," she said. "CSU hasn't found anything in Coyle's house or in his car that ties him to the murders. And before you ask, I checked with Mr. Plunger. All of their trucks were accounted for on Wednesday and Thursday, so he didn't use one of their vehicles." Duncan frowned, but he didn't seem to Eve to be thrown by the setback, at least not to the degree that she was.
"Coyle could have borrowed or stolen a car," Duncan said. "Maybe one that belongs to one of his neighbors or a friend who was out of town."
"Even if he took another car to Tanya's house, we know he went back there again in his own car after he went to Walmart for supplies."
"Maybe he'd finished covering up his tracks as best he could in Tanya's house, hauled away the trash, and dumped the bodies and was going back to mop up the garage," Duncan said. "The floor in there is painted concrete, not blood-soaked carpet. If he was careful, he might have been able to do it without stepping in anything that he'd tracked back into his own car. Even if he did step in something, maybe he dropped his shoes into a trash bag and changed into another pair before getting back in his car."
Eve liked that theory because it ruled out a second person, but it raised almost as many questions as it answered. "But why would he use two different cars to begin with?" Duncan shrugged.
"Why does he dress up as an ape?
Where did he go to clean himself up after he left Tanya's house and before he went to Walmart for more supplies to clean up the garage?"
"The same place where he got the other car, the out-of-town neighbor or friend," Duncan said. "He could have broken into their place, or maybe he has a key and is collecting their mail or walking their dog while they're away. I can have Biddle and Garvey canvass the mobile home park, see if anybody knows something."
"That's a good idea," Eve said, feeling a lot better about the case than she did when she left Nan at Coyle's place. And it was thanks to Duncan. He saw a pothole where she saw a bottomless abyss. Then again, he didn't have as much riding on the case as she did. He had nothing to fear. It gave him the peace of mind to see the case from another perspective. She would remember that lesson.
"What's your next move?" he asked.
"I'll have a talk with Coyle and see what I can bluff out of him now," she said, "unless you have a better idea."
"I wish I did," he said.
Eve went to her desk, printed out some photos, filled a file folder with a bunch of papers as a prop, picked up a yellow legal pad and pen, then went down the hall to the interrogation room. Coyle was already inside and had been for 20 minutes. He slouched in his purposely wobbly chair. He was wearing blue jailhouse scrubs and his hands weren't cuffed. Eve dumped the thick folder and notepad on the table and dropped into the stable chair across from him with a weary sigh.
I'm absolutely exhausted. I would have come to talk to you sooner, but we have been so busy.
Eve patted the thick folder and shook her head.
I've never seen a case come together this quickly. Every time I was about to see you, more evidence and answers would come in. It finally slowed down a bit.
He stared at her, but didn't say a word. She leaned toward him, resting her arms on the table.
I'm not here to question you, Coyle, because we know everything.
There's nothing to know, he said.
Your drawer of souvenirs from the houses you broke into was a big help to us. I almost came by your cell to thank you.
We would have discovered the woman you raped in West Hills when we ran your DNA through the system, but because you kept her tiny teacup, we found her today. She even recognized your monkey mask.
Coyle tried to keep a blank face, but there was an involuntary twitch in his left eyelid that gave away that she'd scored a hit.
Eve kept going.
You left some DNA at Tanya's house and on the hill where you clobbered me, too. I won't bore you with all the evidence.
Coyle stared at her.
Then why are you here?
Eve noted that he didn't deny what she said. That in itself felt like a confession to her, but it wasn't one. She needed more, much more.
Because, between you and me, I'm the one homicide detective in the LASD who does not support the death penalty. We devote ourselves to catching killers, so how can we kill them in cold blood and call it justice? The thing is, what you did was so horrible, and the evidence is so overwhelming that the jury will find you guilty after 30 seconds tops of deliberation, and then they will sentence you to the needle. No question about it. But there's one thing right now I can do to change that outcome, and that you can do to save yourself.
He seemed to sink deeper into his seat. It wobbled from side to side.
What's that?
I can get the DA to take the death penalty off the table if you tell me where they are.
Who?
Eve shook her head like she was disappointed in him.
Come on, Coyle. I'm trying to do you a favor here. Tell me where to find Tanya, Caitlin, and Troy's body parts, and you'll live.
His whole body language changed. He sat up straight and smiled. It was like seeing a puppet being lifted up by his strings and start to perform. She knew in that instant that she'd somehow overplayed her hand. He leaned forward and looked her in the eye with smug satisfaction.
We're done talking, he said. I want to call my lawyer.
Chapter 29. Eve walked out of the interrogation room, the file and notepad under her arm, and didn't let her anger show until the door was closed behind her. She'd tried to play him and somehow got played herself. The door to the observation room opened and Duncan emerged with a woman carrying a briefcase. Eve didn't recognize her. The woman said to Eve,
"Don't be too hard on yourself, detective. It was worth a try. But the bodies are like those souvenirs you found. He doesn't want to give them up. As long as we don't have them, he still does."
Duncan tipped his head toward the woman.
"Do you know ADA Rebecca Burnside?"
Burnside had a grim, serious demeanor that Eve suspected the prosecutor worked hard to maintain to dim the wattage of her fashion model beauty. But her looks were something Burnside curated with care, putting time into applying her makeup, styling her shoulder-length hair, and choosing suits that accentuated her figure without exploiting it. Eve offered Burnside her hand.
"I appreciate your fast work on those warrants."
They shook hands. Burnside's grip was as firm as a linebacker's.
"My pleasure. Let's go to the conference room and you can tell me what we really have on him and what is fake news."
Eve led them down the hall and into the conference room, which was filled by a long table with 10 chairs, 4 on each side and 1 on each end. The blinds were drawn on the window, which looked out over the back parking lot. Burnside took a seat at one end, and the two detectives each took a seat on either side of her. She pulled a legal pad out of her briefcase, set it in front of her, and uncapped a Mont Blanc pen. Let's start with your theory of the case. Lionel Coyle is a plumber who does service calls for insurance companies, Eve said. He goes back to the houses, particularly the ones occupied by women, when they are empty. He dresses up at least partially as an ape and roams around the empty home, searching for something small and personal he can steal as a souvenir that won't be immediately missed. Then something changed. A woman walked in on him in West Hills, Duncan said, and he raped her. You think he liked it and that inspired him to change his M.O., Burnside said. That's right, Eve said. I believe he watched Tanya's house from the hillside behind it and learned her routine. Once he was sure the house was empty, he broke in and waited for her to come home so he could rape her. Something went wrong and the rape became a murder. Things escalated from there and one murder became three, not counting the dog. Burnside made some notes and doodled around some of the words. And in the middle of all this, you think he made a run to Walmart to get more supplies? We think he ditched the bodies and cleaned himself up first, Eve said. But yes, he went out to Walmart, went back to the house to do some last-minute cleanup, then left again. But you believe he came back to the scene of the crime the next morning, Burnside said, when you were already on the scene. That's right, Eve said. He parked his car at the Topanga State Park trailhead down the street, hiked through the park to the hill above Tanya's house, and retrieved his sleeping bag and some other trash that he'd left behind when he was staking out the place. Burnside made some more doodles, giving some of the words a 3D effect and sketching a movie marquee around them. It was the plastic bag in the garage that led you to Walmart and to a suspect. You saw him on surveillance video leave the Walmart in a Toyota Corolla, which you matched to the license plate of a Corolla at the Topanga Park trailhead, which is how you identified Coyle. You obtained a search warrant on his home and car, which you served this morning. Based on what you saw during that initial search, you arrested him for murder. That's correct, Eve said. Burnside leaned back in her chair. What did you see that prompted you to arrest him? We found Caitlin's camera, with photos of her and her brother on the memory card, in his home, and an earring that may belong to her mother, Eve said. We also found a pair of shoes that matched those worn by the killer. But not the actual shoes, Burnside said. No, Eve said. We did find an ape suit, Duncan said. He could have been wearing that mask when he raped the lady in West Hills. Once again, Eve felt the guilt and shame of what her pride had cost her. If she'd told Duncan about being attacked by a monster at the crime scene, the ape suit could have been compelling evidence against Coyle. But she didn't tell anyone, so now it was worthless. It was a huge mistake, one she'd carry for the rest of her life if Coyle got away with the murders. Did the victim really identify the ape mask? Burnside asked. And Eve shook her head. And we don't actually have any DNA evidence, do we? Burnside drilled her with a gaze, and Eve knew the ADA wanted to hear an answer this time. No, Eve said. You're saying that he raped that woman, but all we actually have is a miniature teacup, Burnside said. I haven't researched this yet, but I don't think in the history of criminal law that a miniature teacup has ever led to a rape conviction. He did it, Eve said, angered by Burnside's contempt and even more so by her belief that she probably deserved it. Coyle was rattled when I brought up the rape. I'd be rattled by a false rape accusation too, Burnside said. It wasn't, Eve said. He's a rapist and he's a killer. Burnside didn't argue the point. Okay, let's get back to the killing. Is there any other evidence that's been found in his mobile home or car that ties him to the murders? Duncan spoke up, clearly trying to take some of the pressure off Eve. The camera and the earring put him in Tanya's house. Wasn't he in her house before the murders, fixing their toilet or something? Burnside asked.
Coyle was sent to her house twice by Mr. Plunger, Duncan said. That's when he stole a spare key or unlocked a window so he could slip in later.
How do we know he didn't steal the camera and the earring during those two prior visits? Burnside asked.
We don't, Eve said, sparing Duncan from being the target of Burnside's contempt.
So even if we get lucky and find his DNA in the house, it's worthless, Burnside said. His lawyer will simply argue it was left during those previous visits.
There was a knock on the door. Before Eve could get up to answer it, the door swung open and Captain Moffat came in, followed by Sheriff Richard Lansing. The sheriff glanced at their faces.
I was expecting a celebration, he said. So why does it look like I just walked in on a funeral?
Chapter 30. Moffat and Lansing were both in uniform, as if they were actually prepared to hit the streets for patrol duty, something neither one of them had done in years. Eve, Duncan, and Burnside immediately stood up when they saw the sheriff. Lansing was in his late 50s, square-jawed, square-shouldered, and socially square, the son of a preacher and currently a man besieged, facing a beating scandal at the county jail that seemed to be getting worse every day. Now that he was here, Eve understood who tipped off the media and why, and it made her uncomfortable. He wanted to announce a big arrest to take some of the pressure off himself, even if it was far too soon to do so.
Please sit down, everyone. The captain informed me of the arrest in the Topanga massacre,
Lansing said, closing the door behind him. Eve wasn't aware the case now had a title, and a lurid one at that.
Where do we stand with Coyle?
On thin ice, Burnside said. Eve felt her face flush with anger. Burnside's blunt assessment riled her, but at the same time, she could see the truth behind it. Eve knew with complete certainty Coyle was the killer, even if there wasn't yet enough evidence to prove it in a courtroom.
How do you figure that? Lansing said, taking a seat at the other end of the table. From what I've heard from the captain, we've got a shitload of evidence.
Moffat sat to one side of the sheriff and looked down the long table at Burnside at the far end.
Shitload is the right word, Burnside said. It's entirely circumstantial, and there are big holes in the narrative. We can prove he was in the house, but not on the day of the murder. A good lawyer will tear us apart with that. The only case I could make in court today is for burglary.
Then it's fortunate we aren't in court today, isn't it?
Lansing said.
I believe you are mistaken, Counselor. We have a strong case that's only going to get stronger as more evidence is gathered and analyzed. We have momentum on our side.
I agree, Captain Moffat said.
Of course he did, Eve thought. Both men badly needed a win. Something positive to tell the media that would redirect the spotlight away from their scandals and failures.
Burnside pissed Eve off, but she admired the ADA for her integrity. Burnside wasn't afraid to stand up to the sheriff.
Look what the task force has accomplished already, Lansing said. It's phenomenal. The important thing now is finding the bodies. Everything else will fall into place after that.
Lansing shifted his gaze to Eve.
You took a butcher off the streets in record time. I'm damn impressed.
It was a team effort, sir, Eve said.
Bullshit. You made the key discoveries that led us to Coyle. Own it. You have the right stuff, Ronan. The public saw it in that YouTube video, and so did I. That's why I granted your transfer to RHD, and not to capitalize on your publicity, as some people thought.
Lansing glanced sharply at Moffat, then back to Eve.
I'm having a press conference out front in 10 minutes. I want you, Burnside, and the captain there with me.
Eve wasn't surprised about this immediate press conference, but she was struck by his blatant hypocrisy. He'd just denied that he was motivated by publicity when he promoted her, and then, in the next breath, with a straight face, he'd said he wanted her at a press conference. It was duplicity born out of his desperate political need, now and then, to capitalize on the good news and distract the public from the scandals in the department. But there were dozens of reasons why Eve thought it was a bad idea for the department and the case if they stepped in front of the cameras now. For one thing, Burnside was right. Come Monday, the judge could see that all they had was a burglary case and let Coyle walk out on bail. Then they'd all be humiliated. "I think it's too soon to be holding a press conference," she said. "We shouldn't go public until we have more evidence." Moffat and Burnside stared at her in shock. Duncan simply grimaced. Some color rose in Lansing's cheeks. He glared at her.
"Are you telling me you have doubts about your case?"
"I'm certain that he's the killer," Eve said. "Then I expect to see you express that certainty to those reporters." Lansing got to his feet. "Don't put on any makeup. It's important that they see how hard-working and tired you are."
"Mom will love that," Eve thought.
Lansing walked out and Moffat joined him. Eve looked at Burnside. "You know I'm right."
"I already expressed my opinion and he rejected it," Burnside said.
Duncan nodded in agreement and looked at Eve.
"You should have taken the hint."
"I couldn't just stand by and say nothing," Eve said.
"Yes," Duncan said. "We noticed." Burnside stuffed her legal pad into her briefcase and stood up. "The fact is that we have a suspect in custody. The public will be glad to hear it. That's a win. This press conference will make you a star again."
"I don't want the spotlight."
"But we do." Burnside smiled at her and walked out. Eve revised her opinion of Burnside's integrity. The integrity was there, but it had limitations. It was trumped by her ambition. Burnside was willing to gamble that enjoying the glory today wouldn't lead to shame next week. It was a raw political calculation, and Burnside was probably making a smart bet. If Lansing, Moffat, and Eve went down, Burnside could still come out relatively unscathed, saying she was given a bad case. Eve met Duncan's eye. "I'm fucked."
"Not if you can prove Coyle did it," Duncan said. "How hard could that be?"
Chapter 31. The front steps of the Lost Hills station had become a stage. Lansing stood at a wooden podium with a Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department seal on the front and faced the lights of a dozen TV cameras and 24 print and broadcast reporters. Captain Moffat, ADA Burnside, and Eve stood in the background. Eve wondered where the podium came from, if it was kept in a closet somewhere in the station, or if Lansing carried it around in his Ford Expedition.
"Based on the evidence recovered at the crime scene and the tireless work of our detectives under the supervision of Captain Moffat, we're now certain that Tanya Kenworth and her two children, Caitlin and Troy, were brutally murdered in their Topanga Canyon home on Wednesday," Lansing said. "This is the tragic, heartbreaking outcome that we all feared."
He paused, letting the horrible news sink in, but Eve saw it as a cheap ploy to jack up the drama of the moment. She also had the heart-sinking realization that in their rush to the cameras, nobody had bothered to call Cleve first before they told the world his kids were slaughtered. It was one more cruel, insensitive oversight she'd have to add to her list of regrets in this case. When the sheriff spoke again, there was anger and determination in his face, and his right hand was balled into a fist.
"But justice will prevail, I can promise you that."
Lansing hammered his fist on the podium.
"Because we have a suspect in custody. His name is Lionel Coyle, a man that Assistant District Attorney Burnside will be prosecuting to the fullest extent of the law."
That revelation caused an instant commotion among the press. The reporters all started to fire off questions at once, but Kate Darrow's voice rose above the others.
"What is the suspect's relation to the family?"
"He's a plumber who did some work at the house," Lansing said.
His response prompted a flurry of other questions, only a few of which Eve was able to hear.
"Why did he kill them?
Was the boyfriend or the ex-husband involved? Was he a member of a cult? How were they killed?
Have you recovered the murder weapon?"
Lansing held up his hands in a halting gesture to silence the questions and continue with his statement.
The quick capture of the monster responsible for this heinous crime is due in large measure to the exceptional investigative work of Eve Ronan, the youngest robbery-homicide detective in the history of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department.
He turned and waved her up to the podium. Eve stepped forward, mentally visualizing the notes she'd made on her legal pad, and faced the sheriff before addressing the press. Thank you, sir, but I'm just one of many detectives working on this case and don't deserve the credit. Eve now turned in the general direction of the cameras, the glare of the lights making it impossible to see the faces of the reporters or the lenses. We are all deeply saddened and horrified by this senseless crime. Our hearts go out to the family and loved ones of Tanya, Caitlin, and Troy Kenworth. We won't stop until their bodies are recovered and laid properly to rest.
You said senseless, Kate Darrow said. Does that mean you have no motive for this crime?
Before Eve could answer, Lansing quickly stepped up to the podium and gently, but firmly, shouldered her aside.
We'll be giving you photos of Mr. Coyle in his Toyota Corolla to share with your audience. We are very interested in his movements on Wednesday and Thursday of last week. If you saw him, please call our tip line. You can leave your information anonymously. That's all for tonight. We won't be taking any further questions at this time.
Lansing led Eve, Moffat, and Burnside back into the station as reporters fired off a barrage of questions at their backs.
I don't want any of you talking to the press, Lansing said to the three of them in the lobby. From now on, any contact with the media will go through our media affairs office.
That was an order for Eve and Moffat, but Burnside answered to a different authority, the district attorney, who might want to hold a press conference of his own, but probably wouldn't rush until he saw how Monday's arraignment played out. Eve was headed for the squad room, but Lansing called after her.
Ronan, Lansing said. Could I have a word?
He drew her aside to a corner of the lobby by a wall of framed 8x10s of the sheriff, the captain, and various command personnel. They reminded Eve of the signed headshots from celebrities on the walls of dry cleaners, restaurants, car repair shops,